Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, October 4th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is 60 degrees, overcast and damp here in upstate New York like it has been over the last couple days. And so where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Technology, Dopamine Addiction, and Sucking Our Future into the Machine. We ended the show yesterday looking at the third story over the last few days of a child, and this happened to be the youngest of the three. This kid was about six. He had gotten addicted to Minecraft, and it turned into this child that the parent did no longer recognize. The story before that, Heidi, she was a teenager, and very similar things had happened to her as she had gotten sucked into the machine. We found out about Tay, Microsoft's Hitler-loving sex robot, artificial intelligence experiment. It was supposed to be simulating via artificial intelligence a teenage girl online. Within 24 hours, this AI had gone completely off the edge like they are now seeing with our children. So don't tell me that they didn't know this was going to happen. But that dangling dopamine carrot in humans is the way that they are able to manipulate us with this technology. And as we're having all these little fuzzy robots I saw yesterday, now Toyota, remember I told you, the first foray into a robot in every pot, you know, like the movie iRobot, where everybody had a helper robot at home, and you already see them gearing up, helping elderly, and helping in hospitals, and helping deliver, and helping in warehouses. I mean, they're going to be everywhere. People laugh when I say robots are going to take all the jobs, but it's coming, people. The revolution is coming. I just saw iRobot, as a matter of fact. They not only make vacuum cleaners, but they also used to have a military arm, which they sold off not too long ago. But iRobot just released a new vacuum cleaner, and I got an ad on Facebook last week. It actually came through as an advertisement, which I had to laugh because they base advertisements on the types of things you look at on Facebook. So, of course, I'd been on my Before the First Cup page, and I've been looking at AI or whatever, but I get this ad in my Facebook feed from Best Buy, and it's titled Dyson 360i Robot Vacuum. So not only do we have little robot vacuums now, but we got 360-degree HD camera little robot vacuum cleaners to be ubiquitous in your home, zip around unattended, maybe even unseen half the time, and record everything that they see in here. It intelligently navigates your home, and it schedules cleanings with your smart app. Remember, push a little big green button right on your phone. It'll take care of it for you. Again, that's that dopamine dangling carrot, guys. When I was reading all about dopamine and what releases it, one of the things that were listed was convenience. When we are able to find a way to make a better mousetrap, when we are able to cut steps out of a very long process and make it easier, we get satisfaction out of that. I know I sure do. And this whole pushing forward of merging man's life or man's world with machine's world, and I mean, we've been doing it for multiple generations. Look, even my mother didn't have a refrigerator when she was a kid. We got to see the first VCRs and video games. But now it has moved to a place that was only dreamed about. And you know, I mean, you can look at it on a couple different levels. You can look at it on a cursory level where you're saying, hey, this is so cool. Look at all these new toys. Look at how cool this 360-degree iRobot continuously observing and interpreting my surroundings. This is so awesome. It says this live vision camera captures 30 images per second, so it's real time, to build a complete and continuously updated picture of its environment. So it's going to know who's there, where everybody is, where the cat is. And who knows what they're going to be doing with that information. You know, iRobot, like I said, used to be a military contractor on one side of the house, just like now Toyota. Gotta love Toyota. I always liked Toyota cars. My boyfriend in college had one, and I got to drive it back from Maine to New York. What a sweet little car. That was back in the 80s. It was a Celica. Toyota's now gotten into a partnership with DARPA, and that Gil Pratt, who's the former program manager of the DARPA Robotics Challenge, has now moved over to head up this new artificial intelligence center that Toyota has invested $1 billion into in California. They've also opened a subsidiary factory learning center in Michigan as well, with the University of Michigan. They're really going to push the self-driving car technology. But I saw yesterday, I've been saying for a long time, like, what's really going to push these home robots and this opening our arms to this technology, because this really is the next step, this being able to interact and have some sort of emotional connection to the electronics. And I mean, right now, we're utilizing social media, and there are supposedly people on the other ends, but hey, there's a lot of trolls out there too. So who knows what's real and what's not, what's propaganda and what's truth. It's pretty complicated right now. But they want to take us that next step. And we were reading about Tay, and some of these new chat apps that are coming, they're going to imbue artificial intelligence into a chat app that'll be able to read and respond just like Siri or any of those other apps that are out there that come standard on your cell phone where you can ask it questions. You know, they're really getting people geared up for that. The next level is going to be a humanoid-esque type robot. They need to anthropomorphize the technology now. It can't just be a big, scary Atlas robot or Big Dog or a disembodied voice in the cloud. It's got to be now a, not flesh and blood, but at least have some sort of creature characteristics, maybe where it can respond to facial expressions or respond to your emotions by giving you a smile or jumping up and down excited because you said something. Well, I saw Toyota has now unveiled this little tiny robot the size of a coffee cup that you can interact with. And I think it said it's going to be around $400. And remember, I always said it's about the price point. They've tried a few different price points, like $995. You know, we had Jibo. There was another one I had a story on with a big eyeball on it. I don't remember what it was called. Big Eye, they're calling it. Like, is that not insane? Big Eye social home robot has a big eye, and it launches on Kickstarter. It looks like literally a 60s trash can in the airport. If you remember, they were up, and then they had a rounded top, and they had a round circle where you pushed your hands in, and it opens up. And you could drop your garbage in there. Well, it looks just like that. In case you haven't yet managed to find the perfect social robot for your home, this is Big Eye. It's Big Dash Eye. Big Eye is going to stare at you without blinking until you decide that you want it. And watching, always watching. Does it really say that? This is an IEEE Spectrum, by the way. Seriously, though, Big Eye should get your attention if for no other reason than it's a design that's completely different than anything we have seen before. It's also mobile, and what looks to be a simple and useful if this then that style of verbal programming. The Kickstarter just kickstarted, and already they are just about reaching their goal. And if the giant eyeballs are your thing, and let's be honest, they said everyone has a thing for a giant eyeball. Not me. I used to, you know, when I was a kid, you know, when you're like in junior high school and you have folders, you know, like the paper cut folders, you'd have the thing down the middle and you'd put your three-ring paper in there, and then it had pockets, pocket folder. That's what they called them, all the different colors. I used to draw on mine, you know, over the semester, over the school year. It would get more and more graffitied. And one of the things I used to draw all the time were eyes. I always drew these eyeballs. They're even in my collages. The eyeballs are always up in the corner, which is weird because that was like 70s and 80s. But I guess we've been spied on for a very long time. But now it's just like right in your face. Let's release the Kickstarter robot called Big Eye. It's a natural interaction with robots with mobility, 3D vision, voice programming, and active perception. It can manage smart appliances to suit your needs. And Big Eye can act as a bridge between your family members. It'll improve itself. Now, look at these are another robot that's inserting itself into your household. It's going to get between you and your kids. Remember G-Bo wanted to read, like, bedtime stories, which was absolutely insane? It says, as it improves itself, it becomes more and more thoughtful and intelligent through your instructions. And even when you are away, Big Eye will still take care of your loved ones. Oh, my God. It's a babysitter. Big Eye takes charge of the small daily grind, so you are free to enjoy every precious moment. Convenience. And it means everyone feels the love and the strong bonds of the family. Look at how they pulled on some heartstrings there. To sell this Big Eye. You know, so Toyota also, I have a video on this. I don't know. We might attempt to. Let's see if we can do this. Hold on. We'll see if we can do it. Hopefully it doesn't mess things up. I think it worked. All right, Toyota is unveiling their little coffee cup-sized robot for $400.
And Toyota unveiled a new talking robot, Qrobo Mini. The robot, valued at $390, is 4 inches tall and reportedly has the intelligence of a 5-year-old. Emily Roseman, Associated Press with AP News Minute.
Now, that's going to get a robot in every pot, I think. $390. The intelligence of a 5-year-old, it's four, does she literally say 4 inches tall? It's a little tiny thing. It's got eyeballs, got a head, arms, legs. I'm pretty certain it walks around on your desk. And it can have conversations, at least conversations with a 5-year-old. Pretty frightening. But don't think like that little Toyota bot sitting on every executive's desk now after Christmas 2016. Isn't going to be potentially sitting there with an open microphone with its little camera eyeballs looking over your shoulder at what you're typing on your computer and what you're saying on the confidential financial conference call with the bigwigs. I mean, guys, this is definitely concerning to me. And we've already had this concern for a very long time in IBM ThinkPad. IBM, who was one of the biggies in computer manufacturing and distribution, server manufacturing and distribution for a lot of years, they sold off that server and notebook division to Lenovo, which is a Chinese company. And the federal government used to contract IBM on that FBO.gov. They were one of the approved vendors, so they used to buy a lot of IBM equipment. And they are banned now. I saw a statement out of the State Department a while back saying that no federal agency should be purchasing Lenovo products any longer. And that's exactly why. Because they could potentially be outfitted with some sort of spy electronics coming out of who the hell knows where factory in Yingfuping, China. And then shipped over to all of our federal offices to then open and close microphones and cameras whenever they see fit. Just like we now have, you know, hackers under every bed. It's a real threat, guys. It really is a threat. It's not paranoia. The internet of everything, and we are talking down to a molecular level now. I think we're going to listen to a little tidbit here in a little bit of this very first DARPA podcast with this program manager of Make It, this program that is so damn new that I couldn't even find anything about it really on the internet. But here we have a program manager in DARPA, right off their website, DARPA.mil. DARPA's website, their very first podcast with a program manager talking all about the program. And it's beyond frightening. But here, let's cut through a few of my stories I have queued up before then. And we'll see if we can get a progression going. There's a story that came out of Singularity Hub. This is a publication that is something that Kurzweil first started way back when. This is May 5th, 2016. Machines won't replace us. They will force us to evolve. And about 2 days ago, the title of my show was Dangers of Forcing Human Evolution with Technology. Ding! So funny, there's a story here talking out of Kurzweil's publication about how they are going to force us to evolve. Absolutely, that is what is happening. We saw, looking at the reactions of different individuals to digital heroin, such as they are calling computing devices now, and how us getting sucked into the machine is actually damaging our ability to be social creatures. All mammals are pretty social creatures. We are also warring creatures. And we've had DARPA working behind the scenes for a very long time on multiple different projects, not only involving autonomy and artificial intelligence and all the tools of war, but also molecular engineering and brain projects, brain implants, super soldiers, synthetic biology. And once we realize that much of the funding for this, these advances in science have come from the military-industrial complex, from the black ops money pit. And of course, they sell it and spin it as the pit of innovation, moonshot projects. They invest in things that are one in a million chances to see if they can make them work. And the scary part is that usually they do. Something big is happening in design and engineering, says this article. Machines won't replace us, they'll force us to evolve. For all of human history, we have created tools that help us do what we want to do. You know, like vacuum the floor. And now we have robot 360-degree vacuums. Faster, better, cheaper. But we have always had to direct those tools. Tell them exactly what to do for us to achieve our goals. This hasn't changed from the time of stone tools, which we had to wield with our own hands, to modern digital design tools, which we wield with the click of a mouse. Yes, except now put in diabolical laughter. Exit stage left and in come the robots. If an architect designing a house wants to move a wall, she has to first imagine all the possible alternatives of that wall's placement that will serve her design. But once she has parsed through the possibilities in her mind, she'll make a decision to manually move that wall in her CAD drawing. This is how we've been designing things for most of history. First, you have an idea in your mind, then you draw it. But in recent years, a new era of design has been creeping into the picture, and that is called generative design. A few days ago, CTO of Autodesk, who showed up a few months ago as being the first investors into good old Georgie Church's originally secret meaning of creating the synthetic human genome with 150 scientists at Harvard, but now it's all out there. Autodesk, the company that's putting money where their mouth is to help fund synthetic biology. Yes, that Autodesk, the makers of AutoCAD. They gave a great talk about generative design at a recent conference. And Jeff Kowalski, the CTO, argues that generative design will evolve the roles of designers and engineers from direct operators to then curators and eventually to mentors teaching the machine. No longer required to be the operator of the tools in generative design, the human being. And Flash just crashed. Hold on. That was bizarro. The human being, wherever I was, is free to become the curator. And it crashed again. So I guess we're not going to read Kurzweil's article. Well, that's fucked up. My computers have been giving me a real hard time, just so you know. So anyway, they'll be able to work as a co-creator now with the computer versus being the engineer of experience. Like, in the old days, and I mean being close to my heart, being a design engineer for networks, that was what made your skills precious, is that you had the experience. You've done 100 different networks, just like this one. And you've already worked all the kinks out of the design, and you've run into all the issues that any of the greenies haven't seen yet. And you can lend your experience to the design to get around any of the pitfalls that maybe others might not know about. That's what makes your services and your skills worth paying for. Well, how's that going to turn? I mean, you're talking well-paid professionals to do this stuff on a daily basis. Adaptive design is going to take an entire segment of white-collar, educated and seasoned professionals out of the workforce. We've talked about the Internet of Everything, which is the next evolution of the Internet of Things, which is on this exponential upswing. The Internet of Everything is going to take frequencies across the spectrum from terahertz and microwave to even optical, utilizing Wi-Fi and some of the crazy stuff we've talked about. Mix and match and send high-capacity audio and video and real-time biostats, remote sensing capabilities to some sort of cloud-based surveillance network. We've seen them already building this network as a collaboration between NASA and Verizon and many of the other technology companies. We have Google and Facebook. We even have the Air Force. We have NASA. We have universities participating. They're all building these little devices, the CubeSats, at least in that case, the little mini cell towers that we heard Jeremy Johnson, I think that's what his name was, Jeremy, the cell phone guy who came out and talked about frequencies, the former civil engineer out of Silicon Valley with the sensitivity to the frequencies. You know, they are taking this to a level where it'll be out of sight, out of mind. Remember, if you can't see it, it's not there. That's what the simplistic mind usually thinks. If you can't see it and it's not in your face, well, it's not a big deal then. It's not reality television. It's not something that's going to affect me immediately, give me instant gratification or instant pain, which is the opposite of instant gratification. You know, burning lasers from the sky on your skin would be instant pain that you would have to drop everything and react to. But if it isn't burning a laser hole in your skin, and it's something that's maybe a boiling frog, right? It's a lot easier for these things to continue for a very long time until they get to critical mass. Out of this publication, technology.org, DARPA Spectrum Collaboration Challenge. This was posted yesterday. The DARPA Spectrum Collaboration Challenge is the first of its kind collaborative machine learning competition to overcome scarcity in the radio frequency spectrum. Now, there's all these licensed bandwidths out there, and there's some open public bandwidths. They've been doing some manipulation over the last few years, the FCC, where they went from analog to digital television was one of the big movements to be able to free up more radio frequency spectrum for first responders, emergency networks, at least those are what they say, of course, military stuff, and some of the older bandwidths, because they are crying that there is a shortage that is coming. Just like in the IP space, when we were talking about IP addressing schemes way back when, back in the old days, we had what was called IPv4. It was three stanzas, three numbers each. And when they saw the Internet of Everything coming back in the early 2000s, they'd already started crying Chicken Little. Say, we got to expand the numbering space. We have to increase the number of stanzas to be able to give us a close to unlimited numbering system for all of these new millions, if not billions, of devices that are to come online here in the future. Well, this is very much some of the same mentality that is now looking at the radio frequency spectrum. Today, the spectrum is managed by dividing it into rigid, exclusively licensed bands. And that's what I was talking about. The FCC does all that. They maintain all that. They manage it all. And this is a human-driven process, of course. So remember, imperfect humans. And it is not adaptive to real-time dynamics of supply and demand. And guys, this is where the cloud all really came from. In the old days, you used to connect to a single server. If you were a corporation, you had 200 people. Everyone connected to, ten computers. But each computer had to handle the load on its own. And typically had information for one thing here, and then you had to go to that server to get some things over there. And every time you hit that server, you hit that server's CPU and that server's memory and that server's hard drive. And if that server went down, whoops, you lost access to all that data. But then the cloud came along. Load balancing was kind of where it started, where you were clustering multiple computers together. And you would take that hard drive and you'd put it in an external storage device. So when you would go to that hard drive, you would hit not one but two computers' processors, two computers' memories that were sharing the workload. They literally had a cable connected between them called a heartbeat link. So they could tell what the other one was doing, and they could share information, and they could share processing power that were both then connected to this external storage device, where the hard drive, probably in some sort of fail-safe configuration, we'd have multiple hard drives all painting data across multiple drives. So if you lost one, you wouldn't lose your data at all. Could even, like, hot rebuild it all by itself. If a hard drive died, it could figure out what was missing and rebuild it if you had a spare sitting out there. That was really the next generation. And that was a poor man's autonomy. You were doing it in software. It wasn't figuring things out as different circumstances arose, but at least it had fail-safe built into it. So if it was 3 o'clock in the morning and something went down, network administrators didn't have to get out of bed and trudge through a snowstorm to go to work in the server room and figure out what was going on. But then the next step beyond that was the cloud, and Amazon really changed that with this huge, 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 huge data center in the cloud of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of machines, evenly or unevenly, doesn't really matter, distributed across the globe, all connected to the full-ass big connector core backbone of what we affectionately call the Internet. And then you didn't have to even hit a location on your network anymore. You could. You'd hope it would be encrypted, at least. But it was in the cloud. You could subscribe to a service that would give you some sort of VPN tunnel, all encrypted tunnel, to get from point A to point B without being able to be sniffed. and then hit these thousands of CPUs and memory cores that are all working together on demand. And every time there's a need over there, well, they dedicate some resources over there, and then they dedicate some resources over here. You know where all that technology came from? Just as a side note, was the original SETI project, if you remember that, back in the early 90s. My computer was a part of that. All of us downloaded this little app that we ran on our machines. And when your computer was on, but sitting idle, the software would utilize your CPU cycles to help fuel the data crunching that was going on for the signals that they were detecting from space. And it was a global project. People from all over the world participated and offered their CPU cycles to help crunch numbers. Well, now it's gone from being this open sourced technology to this corporate overarching frightening place. I mean, we've had Kurzweil talk about the cloud that lives in ubiquitous outer space somewhere. I mean, I saw a question the one day, I think I talked about this, they had to actually ask, they did the survey with millennials, like, where is the cloud? And people are like just so beyond clueless. They have no idea. Cloud is everywhere. The cloud is wherever Amazon and all these huge organizations now, including Facebook and Microsoft and everybody, everyone's got a cloud, NSA. It's wherever it lives, distributed in multiple places, sharing data, cross-platform, collating, and now they're all run by artificial intelligence, a lot of the self-healing immune systems for data networks going to be a part of this. And this Internet of Everything, which we're going to look at the DARPA Spectrum Collaboration Challenge, this Internet of Everything is going to suck now the molecular space, eventually, all in the name of precision medicine and CRISPR and DARPA make it programs, molecular machines and manufacturing. It's going to pull us all into that cloud at a cellular, molecular level. But in order to do that, DARPA's got to get this Internet of Everything radio spectrum all figured out. So today, of course, the spectrum is managed by dividing it into rigid, exclusively licensed bands, and the human-driven process is not adaptive to the dynamics of supply and demand. It's not like the cloud yet. And thus, it cannot exploit the full potential capacity of the radio spectrum. But in this spectrum collaboration challenge of DARPA's, competitors will reimagine a new, more efficient wireless paradigm in which radio networks now become autonomous. Ding! It's not just the robots, not just the drones, it's not just the cars, not just the little nanobots in your blood. No. Now it's going to be the radio networks as well. The radio networks themselves that are transmitting this information. Every butterfly wing flutter and sneeze and fart you make is going to be transmitted by autonomous radio networks that collaborate to dynamically determine how the spectrum should be used moment to moment. The team whose radio design most reliably achieves successful communication in the presence of other competing radios could win as much as $3,500,000. So guys, just like that grand cyber challenge that we just had, the hacker fair in Nevada, it's come up with the shape-shifting immune system for the Internet of Everything. Then we had the DARPA robotics challenge. Multiple, it was good old Gil Pratt's baby. He's now moved over to Toyota's $1 billion artificial intelligence center. The DARPA Robotics Challenge, again, offered big prizes for people who come up with a humanoid robot that could do all kinds of things and be used for military, as well as for, you know, loading boxes in a distribution center. That's how they showed them in the video. I don't think it's going to be used exclusively in a warehouse, guys. But we're using our children to create these technologies of autonomy that are about to replace us from every single angle. And now even being able to real-time pull out that Swiss Army knife. Whatever bandwidth you need, you got it, baby. This SC2 competition across the nation and around the world, the wireless revolution is fueling a voracious demand for access to radio frequency spectrum. And in the civilian sector, consumer devices from smartphones to wearable fitness recorders to smart kitchen appliances are all competing with bandwidth. In the military, there is growing reliance on unmanned platforms from underwater sensors. I almost said underwear, but from underwear too. Smart underwear, Under Armour, and IBM. Two satellites, soon to be the little CubeSats. And a push for broadband connectivity for every single member of the armed services. Yeah, it's going to be in their little wireless contact lenses. Managing this increasing demand while combating what appears to be the looming scarcity of the RF spectrum is a serious problem for our nation. Oh my God, all in the name of national security. That's how they spin it. Today's approach, which is nearly a century old, isolates wireless systems by dividing the spectrum into rigid, exclusively licensed bands. Yes, which, you know what? If you make a phone that works on whatever frequency and you buy the rights to license that frequency, you can guarantee when you sell your phone to the masses that works on that wireless frequency that there probably won't be too much interference because you have licensed that frequency. Well, don't worry about it, because now we're just going to dynamically allocate frequency spectrum on demand. Because this old approach rations access to the spectrum in exchange for the guarantee of interference-free communication. However, it is human-driven and not adaptive to the dynamics of supply and demand, and at any given time, many allocated bands are unused by licensees while other bands are overwhelmed, thus squandering the spectrum's enormous capacity and unnecessarily creating conditions of scarcity. Guys, this is cloud technology that they are now looking to apply to wireless bandwidth. Like, even a crazy little mind like mine, who's worked a lot of years engineering systems, never thought of anything like this. It's pretty ingenious, but it's very scary that it's DARPA that's going to be putting out this grand challenge and offering $3.5 million to the winner to create this shape-shifting, on-demand ability to have bandwidth at a level we've never seen before. To be able to take frequencies, and if they really wanted, like, they literally could take control of the whole thing all at once for their own purposes. Then they're going to put it autonomous. What level of human control is going to be involved? Is there an override? You know, we've been looking at that a lot with artificial intelligence. Where's the kill switch? I really would like to see a kill switch. And something that's not controlled by a band of lunatics. This spectrum collaboration challenge aims to ensure that the exponentially growing number of military and civilian wireless devices will have full access to the increasingly crowded electromagnetic spectrum as we get sucked into the Internet of Things. Competitors will reimagine spectrum access strategies and develop new wireless paradigms in which radio networks will autonomously collaborate and then reason Ding. Reason. Think. Think about things. They will actually take a look at something and come up with the best design on demand for this moment of the radio frequency spectrum. Guys, again, this is something in provisioning that's done a really high level of engineering. This is backbone engineering. And it could be even down in a city level, but even when you get to backbone engineering, that's a high-paying job. Those are communication engineers. That's a high-paying job, guys. And they are working on creating software that'll be able to do it not only autonomously, but collaborate with other devices and then reason out, based upon conditions, what the best design is going to be. Avoiding interference and jointly exploiting opportunities to achieve the most efficient use of the available spectrums. These teams will develop breakthrough capabilities by taking advantage of recent advances in artificial intelligence and machine learning and the expanding capabilities of software-defined radios. So you don't have to swap out an ASIC anymore. You can just do an update anytime you write some new fancy stuff into the software. Do a BIOS update, zoop, and you got a new machine. And ultimately, this competition aims not only to challenge innovations in academia and business to produce breakthroughs in collaborative AI, but also to catalyze a new spectrum paradigm that can help usher in a new era of spectrum abundance. And spectrum abundance means connections in your face everywhere, every minute of the day, at every level. Guys, this is that net that was dropping down over us now doesn't have the big crisscross hole patterns. Now it's got the little tiny ones. And they're going to start making those little tiny crisscross patterns on that net out of metal. Soon to be graphene that we won't even be able to cut to get out. Air Force seeks autonomous systems that learn and adapt. This is another story. This one's from February 2016. To address the needs for systems that can operate in contested environments, the Air Force is looking to advance machine intelligence by developing and testing resilient autonomous systems that can assess, yes, I said assess, recover, learn, and adapt from adverse events, both benign and hostile. A new broad agency announcement for a four-year, $7 million resilient autonomous systems program calls for research proposals that will demonstrate the benefits of improved resiliency, and that's what they call it when you load balance, too. This is all about resiliency in a simulated but realistic Air Force domain. This project will focus on activities related to machine intelligence without a human in the loop. Guys, they're going forward with this. All those scientists, including Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and even Billy Gates and Wozniak and a lot of others, have come out against autonomous machines and have warned about artificial intelligence. You know, when we start creating these creatures that mimic human thoughts and can do swarm learning like the Borg, adding their intelligence to the cloud and being able to then draw upon that intelligence exponentially as each individual point on that network gains more knowledge and uploads it to the cloud, all the other points on the network have access to that knowledge. So is that Baxter Robot? We already saw MIT Technology Review did a story about that, where these robots were all over, distributed. They were learning different skills, and they were uploading their skill program to the Baxter Cloud that all other Baxters could access on the fly. Guys, we are in a danger zone. How do you compete against an entire globe of autonomy? Autonomous security systems on the internet, autonomous drones flying in the sky, autonomous radio frequencies that are going to make a determination whether or not you are worthy to receive radio spectrum for your connected device. Autonomous internet drones, autonomous cars that are going to be run by beams, terahertz beams from the sky. Autonomous satellites. It's just insane. With no human intervention. Technologies must prove to be effective command and control for at least 100 fully autonomous assets within intermittent and degraded communication environments, as well as prove capabilities of learning from prior experiences. So they want to be able to control from one endpoint 100 fully autonomous assets that may or may not be connected back to command and control at all times. And in order to assess the capabilities of technologies presented, solutions will participate in simulations which opposing forces, such as red teams, will attempt to disrupt specific intelligence, surveillance, or reconnaissance missions within a 72-hour window. So again, they're going to have another grand cyber challenge-ish type thing, except this is for the Air Force, which is very connected to DARPA, by the way. Proposers must then develop and implement a fully autonomous solution capable of planning, coordinating, and controlling of the friendly or blue team forces. Possible approaches that could enable resilient autonomous solutions include distributed planning and constraint optimization, multi-agent coordination, distributed information management, learning features, reinforcement learning, transfer learning, case-based reasoning, and ding ding game theory and opponent modeling. You know, we had talked about video games, that dopamine effect, and back 20 plus years ago when I first saw that very first video game skewed by the Department of Defense that has done a really good job of training a whole generation of drone pilots who sit in a room with a joystick. Soon to be now drone managers for autonomous fleets that work in swarms. And to add insult to injury, hey, can't let DARPA and the Air Force and universities and all this other crazy, crazy gaggle of mad scientists get involved without involving the post office. Me too. The United States Postal Service is now proposing smart cities data collection scenarios. Smart cities data collection. Yes, well, the good old post office has been involved in a very long time. We read about in 2001-ish, shortly thereafter, maybe it's 2006, after the anthrax attacks, quote unquote, they had implemented the scanning technology in the post office that can see through packages we discovered using terahertz. To be able to determine what is in a package, they already have GPS coordinates for everybody's doorway and your mailbox. They are working as this last mile delivery service now for a lot of the big boys, the commercial posting services that don't typically surveil you. But don't worry about it, because the post office is here. They will get the last mile. Make sure they get that photograph of the to and from, and they are doing that, by the way, and scan it through their terahertz scanner to see what's inside and be able to molecularly determine what is in a package. Well, now the United States Postal Service is proposing they want to be a part of the smart cities, ubiquitous computing and connectivity, Internet of Everything, for their data collection. Any smart city initiative requires an extensive mobile networks infrastructure to collect data. Ding! And that is where the United States Postal Service thinks that it can help. Oh, yes. Thank you, Postal Service. A new white paper. This is from September 30th, by the way. New white paper from the United States Post Office of the Inspector General proposes a 5-year pilot program that would demonstrate how the United States Postal Service can help advance smart city technology. The idea of the, quote, Internet of Postal Things was introduced in a 2015 white paper that discussed how connected technologies could help the United States Postal Service improve its own operational efficiency. And this new report addresses how the Postal Service can use the Internet of Things to accelerate the adoption of smart city technology. Two of the 5 potential pilot programs would take place in Pittsburgh, in partnership with Carnegie Mellon University. Ding! How interesting that they were just the ones that won that DARPA Cyber Challenge. Carnegie Mellon. And one of these projects would involve placing cameras and develop software in 10 of the United States Postal Service vehicles to monitor road conditions, as well as to identify cracks and potholes. Another would connect an accelerometer to postal vehicles to pick up vibrations while crossing bridges on the vehicle's normal route. And this data would help monitor conditions of the infrastructure. The same technology is already used by the city's light rail system. We will put the whole postal physical infrastructure on the table for people to use, he said. Cities very quickly came back to us with the vehicle over and over again because it is a power supply and you can attach a sensor and not have any involvement by the letter carrier. A pilot proposed by Montgomery County, Maryland would be able to use the USPS vehicles to pick up data from sensors on fire hydrants as well as water pipes in the ground to detect problems in the underground water infrastructure in Portland, Oregon. They have a pilot that would attach air quality monitors to the vehicles as well. This project proposed for the New York Capital Region is a little bit different. That's in the Albany region. It would rely on postal carriers' knowledge of the neighborhoods they serve. Oh, no, we got our little spy postman. I thought there was a program like that, See Something, Say Something, way back when, where the post office and the postal carriers were like the first line of defense if they saw anything fishy. This was back quite a number of years ago already. They were to report it. They also, if there was some sort of like pandemic, we were told that they were going to utilize the post office to deliver drugs to every mailbox in a neighborhood if need be. An application could be created for the carrier's device to capture this knowledge of the neighborhood to allow more consistent input of information about properties. In order to detect early signs of blight, so they're going to report you if your lawn's not mowed. For example, the carrier could report that a house is falling into disrepair or that a mailbox has been emptied for a very long time. And the research is meant to find more valuable meaning in the existing United States postal infrastructure and maybe even increase the agency's bottom line. How frightening is that? We're going to have an agency of spies now from the post office that are going to start feeding into this Internet of Things, this Internet of distributed information about everything that then has artificial intelligence applied on top of it to be able to parse and draw conclusions for things such as, oh, I don't know, pre-crime. Pre-crime, guys, we've read a lot about it. And it's not just about facial expressions or trying to determine if you come from an ethnicity that might, statistically speaking, mean that you have more of a chance of committing a crime. No, this is pre-crime by looking at things in the environment, uses of technology, patterns, to determine whether or not you could potentially be a criminal. All right, guys, we're going to continue here tomorrow. Make sure you stick around. Kevin Blanch is live up next. Have an awesome Tuesday. I will catch up with you later. Everybody take care.
you go from having something that can form life to something that explodes, to something that makes beautiful colors, to something that makes your cookies smell great and taste great. You know, it's all chemistry.
You're a molecules guy.
Yeah.
There actually are not that many molecules people here at DARPA, which is interesting. So as a rep of this minority, how are you taking that interest in the form of programs?
In the Defense Sciences Office, one of the things that's going on right now, one of the zeitgeists, is revolutionizing science. How do we do science, but faster, better? And one of the things that is interesting about chemistry, especially when we're talking about the makers, the people who make materials, make small molecules, make medicines, it's a really slow process. I really like the idea of reinventing science, and in chemistry, there's a lot of opportunity to reinvent the science.
So let me ask, when you say reinventing science, I mean, do you mean the actual process that we were asking questions, the way we're trying to answer those questions? And if can you be a little more detailed about what you have in mind?
Chemistry is a tough subject. We have lots of parameters that we don't often know how we're controlling them. But if we did all of the chemistry in a much more controlled environment, where the environment was being constantly monitored, we might come up with much, much more reproducible chemistry, which will then mean it can be transportable. So in other words, if I have a machine that's doing the chemical reaction and recording how it's done, then that code, that record, can be sent from one lab to another. So you could accelerate it. In the same way that the internet allowed you to accelerate how information was transportable, what if you could do that with molecules?
Tyler, this might be a good time to talk a little bit about the Make It program. So can you say a little bit about what you're doing there?
Make It is a platform technology for making small molecules. And in this particular case, what we're trying to do is we're trying to democratize chemistry. So what if you could have a system that a biologist or any scientist came up and typed in the target, and the machine figured out how to make it, even if there was no recipe available, so that the machine would figure out a possible set of ways to make something, and then would go about testing each one of those ways until it found a solution. Then it would log that solution in a cloud or in its data bank, and now that molecule could be made anytime. And in addition, the system would also figure out how to make more of it.